Thank you very much. I think that's probably. I start. I want to tell you a story about a very special gardener. Unlike other gardeners, this gardener started with absolutely no raw ingredients. There was no garden, there was no soil, there was no sunlight, there were no atoms. But he started to create a garden from nothing. Not the kind of garden that we might have or our parents might have, but this garden filled the whole planet. He made jungles in this garden where the leaves you can kind of shelter under. They're like umbrellas. He made lakes so calm you could lie on a unicorn-shaped lilo and drink a cocktail. He made deserts, mangroves, prairies, the Arctic ice. At the right time of year, he made leaves that are the color of lipstick. And you go under the water and you see coral the color of candy floss. Absolutely beautiful. And in the garden, which was beautiful, he made animals of all kinds. So hummingbirds as small as bees, whales as big as buses, squirrels that fly, bees that dance, worms that eat mud, goats that eat anything, dolphins that smile, crocodiles that grin. We know hyenas laugh. He made butterfly fish and parrot fish, and lion fish and catfish and batfish and hogfish and dogfish, hairy caterpillars, bald eagles, beavers that make dams, moles that dig tunnels, pelicans with beaks that you could put your shopping into, sharks with razor-sharp teeth, beetles with antlers, gorillas as strong as any gym bunny could ever want to be, toads that kind of blow themselves up like balloons, and the animals, they sing and squawk and spout and hiss and hoot and howl and honk and chirp and peck and pounce and fly and bounce and slither and squirm and crawl and creep and prowl and growl and gallop and glide and dive and swoop and jump and warble and squeak. And like, we just run out of words for what God's animals can do. Absolutely incredible. It was a beautiful garden, and that kind of stuff is just amazing. We're glued in front of our TVs when we see that sort of thing. But the greatest thing he made, this great gardener, was man and women, people like us, junior gardeners. And he made the garden for us to enjoy, because he wanted us to be the sort of people that climb trees and sit in the tree on a summer's afternoon and feel the breeze on our faces. The sort of people that wake up in the mornings and see it snowing and they just think, it's come from heaven, it's changed everything. The sort of people who, when you're on holiday, you dig your toes into the sand and you just think, isn't life brilliant? He wanted us to enjoy his creation. And so he basically said, this garden, I'm giving it to you, and I want you to rule and subdue it. And that was his way of saying to the junior gardeners, you're in charge, so look after it. So that's what these junior gardeners started doing. They planted crops, they started pruning their apple trees. They started caring for the animals. It was paradise. It was Eden. But then something went very wrong, because one day the junior gardeners did something and a curse crept in and ruined everything. It was a kind of like a poison, the worst kind of pesticide that got into the soil and changed it forever, and there was no going back. Sin that affected the soil and the sun and the skies and the plants and the animals. And because of the curse, the fires started burning and the tsunami started flooding. And because of the curse, the junior gardeners, the worst thing was, they started treating the garden as if it were theirs. They forgot that the senior gardener had given it to them, and they forgot he'd said, "Will you care for it?" He'd said to them, "Subdue and rule," and they started thinking, "We'll spoil and we'll ruin." So they start cutting down more forests so they can have bigger houses. And they start treating the animals really badly because it means they can sell their chicken breasts more cheaply. They start filling the oceans with plastic so that they have convenience. And this beautiful, good world, after long, is not quite as good as it used to be. That is the story, isn't it, of our world. God is the senior gardener, we're the junior gardeners, and he's entrusted us with his beautiful, beautiful planet. And the problem is, we've been treating it a bit like this wheelbarrow over here. If you can't see it, I'll just kind of describe it, and I suppose for the people listening, it's a knackered old wheelbarrow from Kellaway Builders Merchant. It cost me £20, and I was loath to even spend £20 on like a wheelbarrow. But it's rusted. I left it out in the garden. I've shipped like big bits of stone in it, clearing up our garden. The first wheel's broken. The second wheel's about to go out. It lives outside, and it's not in good nick. It only cost me £20. And the point is, I don't really care how I use it, okay? I don't care. I mean, I'm just going to do this. Like, it really does not matter. And I'm uptight about these kinds of things. We've got two young boys, and they are often throwing stuff I really care about, and I get quite tense about it. But they could do whatever they want to the wheelbarrow. I wouldn't care. It's a cheap wheelbarrow. And what we see in Genesis, what we see of what's been happening to our world, is we've been treating it a bit like a wheelbarrow. Something really functional that we just use for benefit and abuse. We didn't care about it. It's a wheelbarrow. And actually, the way the Bible speaks about God's world is less like a kind of functional wheelbarrow just there to use and abuse, and more like this, a very, very beautiful engagement ring. Now, the question about what is so beautiful about this? Well, engagement rings are often made of like silver or gold or platinum, and they would often, and in fact do, this one does, have a very nice diamond in it. So those are rare elements, aren't they? You can't just scrabble around in the dirt and kind of find a diamond unless you're extraordinarily lucky. Okay, so that makes it very precious. It takes a lot of work to get the raw ingredients. But of course, probably what makes it even more precious is it represents the moment that one person said to another, "Do you want to live with me? Do you want to get married? For the rest of our lives, we'll love each other. It'll be brilliant." So relationally, they're incredibly, incredibly precious. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a volunteer. Matt, do you want to come up? We're going to sing soon, but what I want Matt to do is look after this engagement ring. It's Millie's. I've just borrowed it off her. In fact, she gave it to me surprisingly easily. I could have just legged it straight away. But it is very, very precious. I'd like you to look after it whilst we sing our next song, and then we'll get you back to give us some feedback after the song. Is that all right? Great. Ed. Please have a seat. Matt, do you want to come up? Okay. Have you still got it? He's still got it, Millie. He still got it. Tell us, what was it like looking after that for us?
There's some pressure. I've warmed up a little bit. I had to unbutton my shirt.
Why was there pressure?
It was a value to us. It was a value to us, and I can't lose it.
And you know Millie, so you daren't. Yeah. Thank you very much. The Bible says we've been treating God's garden planet like a cheap wheelbarrow rather than a precious engagement ring. The American author Wendell Berry, who is a strange combination, like an author and a farmer and a Christian. I mean, I'm sure those come together regularly as combinations. But he was an environmentalist from the 60s. And so when someone from that long ago caring about a topic which at the time no one cared about speaks about it, you listen. And this is what he says. We have an environmental crisis because we have consented to an economy in which by eating, drinking, working, resting, traveling, and enjoying ourselves, we're destroying the natural, God-given world. We get out of it everything we want, and as we do that, we kick it over. We use and abuse. Now, these days, of course, there are loads of non-Christian voices calling for us to care for the environment. And what I want you to see is just that the Christian voice is particularly unique because we, as God's family, we have the greatest reason to care. Because we know that the world around us, the views, the jaguars, the vines, the flowers, are not just a random collection of atoms that have come into being. We know that they are the engagement ring God has given us. Something that was very precious to him, and he says to us, I want you to have it. He's given it to us like an engagement ring. And so I take it that just like Matt did, we are doing all we can to care for it and to stop it being damaged. Because that's what God has called us to do. So when we're walking along and we see litter, I think our instinct should be we pick it up. When we're wondering whether or not to buy a new item of clothing, our instinct should be, well, be careful before you do, because of all the kind of energy that goes into creating that thing. Do you really need it? As we're thinking about getting a new mobile phone when our contract runs out, we should be thinking about the environmental impact of buying a brand new headset, phone set, before we could just get a refurbished one. As we think about these things, there's a real danger that we just sit there and go, oh yeah, I really should care about the environment. It's the right thing to do. But I hope you see that if you understand that the world around us is like an engagement ring from the Lord that he's given us out of love, it's less about doing the right thing and it's more about realizing how much he loves us. And so we love him back in the practical decisions we make. We love God in the way we treat the world he's given us. But we also love our neighbor in the way we treat the world around us, because we are all just 8 million neighbors at the end of the day, aren't we? 8 million neighbors. And he hasn't given it to just some of us to enjoy. We're all to enjoy it. But the problem is when some of us treat it particularly like a cheap wheelbarrow, that has impacts on everyone, doesn't it? So, for example, just at a local level, the air pollution just out these doors is, I think, roughly twice the legal limit. I mean, it's incredible that that's allowed to happen. And so when we drive when we don't need to, we are harming others. Recent reports suggested that 300 early deaths a year happen because of the air pollution in the city. Lives that end earlier than they otherwise would have had the air been cleaner. And speaking as a father of children who have kind of like asthma or asthma-induced breathing issues, it's heartbreaking because the younger lungs suffer the most. The younger lungs suffer the most. So when we get out of our cars onto our bikes, when we protest, when we write to the mayor saying, you've got to do something about this, people are dying, we're loving God and we're loving our neighbors. It may seem very practical. In fact, it is very spiritual. Now, there are loads of things we could do, and now is not the time to kind of run through all the things we can do to kind of care about the planet, and you guys know as much as I do about that. But I think what I want to try and show you is that here is the framework to hang it on, the reasons to care. And wouldn't it be brilliant if in small groups, if with your housemates, you can start chatting about what are the ways we can live as if God's planet is more like an engagement ring and less like a wheelbarrow. But here's the thing, because so far, that message sounds quite like the message of the world out there. Care. Care. And live carefully. So what is particularly distinctive here? And I think it's this. As much as we should care for our planet and do our best to look after it, only when Jesus comes back to reverse the curse is the real change going to happen. So do you remember the story we started with? The senior gardener, God, gave Adam and Eve responsibility to look over the garden, but they sin against God. And it doesn't just ruin their friendship with God, it actually ruins the garden itself. There's a curse. You see, our natural world is cursed because of their sin, and it's cursed because of our sin. And so no matter how we should, we must be really clear, we cannot take things back to Eden. We cannot restore paradise. We cannot ultimately fix things. Only Jesus can do that, because only he can reverse the curse. And he's promised that one day when he comes back, he's going to wash the sin out of the soil. And boy, has it gone deep. But he's going to wash it out and fix this natural world. And that is just one of the reasons we think Jesus is brilliant. We think he's brilliant because when he comes back, the relationship between us and God is going to be fixed. When he comes back, the relationship between us and each other is going to be fixed. And here's the thing, when he comes back, the relationship between us and the world around us, the natural world, that is also going to be fixed. And so often, as Christians, we've ignored that third dimension. That is, he is going to fix the soil and the skies. Now, there's a bit of an objection that sometimes Christians raise at this point. And they will say, hey, look, there are some passages in the Bible which suggest that God is basically, at some point in the future, he's going to destroy this natural world and give us a new one. He's going to give us a new heavens and a new earth. And because he's going to give us a new heavens and a new earth, why does it really matter what we do now with our planet? Should Christians really care? Haven't we got other things to be doing? And I think it'd probably just helpful for at least us to look at one of the verses I'll most commonly go to. So if you flick open 2 Peter chapter 3, I think on the Bibles you've got, it's 1224, page 1224. We'll read from verses 10 to 13. Now remember, we're reading this because some Christians will point to these and go, God's going to destroy the world and renew it, so it doesn't matter how we treat it. Okay? The day of the Lord will come like a thief. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire. And the earth and everything done it will be laid bare. Since everything will be destroyed in this way, what kind of people ought you to be? You ought to live holy and godly lives as you look forward to the day of God and speed its coming. That day, which is the day when God will come to judge the world, will bring about the destruction of the heavens by fire and the elements will melt in heat. But in keeping with this promise, we're looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. So what exactly is going on here? Well, Peter is speaking. He's saying, look, there is a day of judgment coming. It's not metaphorical. It's really going to happen. And it turns out that that judgment day isn't just about God dealing with the relationship between him and us. It's actually dealing with the natural world. The day of judgment involves soil. And what's he going to do, verse 13? He's going to give us a new heaven and a new earth. But there's language here of destruction, isn't there? There's language here of a fire on Judgment Day that will destroy. And so people are going, well, hang on, if he's going to destroy it all, why should we care about it? Now, they are kind of quite tricky verses here. But I think for a few reasons, I want to kind of try and persuade you that I wouldn't let these verses stop us caring for the world God has given us. The first reason is the language here of fire, which is what's associated with the destruction. Fire, in the way Peter uses, is often used with purification. Okay? So particularly in 1 Peter chapter 1, fire purifies. So think about it like this. You've got your gold marriage ring, and you melt it down, and as you melt it down, you can kind of pull all the impurities out of it. But then it solidifies again. So in a sense, once you've done that, you've got a new ring, right? It's new. But actually, it's the same old ring that the impurity has been pulled out. It's been refined. And I think that is a picture for what's going to happen. The soil that is stained with sin, it's going to be purified. It's not language of total destruction and starting again. It's language of purification, renewing, refreshing, making even better. There's continuity. So just as we started in the book of Genesis, what was there? A garden. And it was wonderful. But then it goes wrong. But if you flick towards the very end of Genesis, very end of Revelation, Revelation chapter 22, just flick there with me. This is the picture for where we're all heading, okay? It's amazing. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, as clear as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb down the middle of the great street of the city. On each side of the river stood the tree of life, bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree for the healing of the nations. There's a picture here, and earlier on in Revelation, that where we're all heading, it's another garden. Except it's a garden city. It's even better than Eden. So do you see, the story starts in a garden, but God doesn't just get rid of it and start afresh. He takes us to a garden city. The world is going to be like it was, but better. And that is one of the reasons why we keep caring for our planet. Because God said, look after it. We keep caring for it because God said, love the Lord. We keep caring it because he says, love your neighbor. And we keep caring for it because he's saying, that's where it's going to be. We don't just stop and throw up our hands and say, he's making it all new, so I won't bother at all. It's a bit like if you think about your godliness. We know in the new heavens and new earth we're going to be made godly. Does that mean we just don't care about it now? We just think, well, he's going to make me perfect. I'll crack on with sinning. No way. It's just like that with the new heavens and new earth. He's going to make it perfect. In the meantime, we take his command to care for it very seriously. Let me tell you a little bit about the Italian artist Michelangelo. Often for his commissions, he would be required to paint ceilings of some famous buildings, including buildings like the Sistine Chapel. And the way he would tend to do it is he'd have his sort of apprenticed artists who would come ahead of him, and they would prepare the surface of the ceilings. Like, this ceiling is an okay nick, but we can already see, like, you know, there's paint flaking everywhere. You want to watch your head, don't you? So what they do is they would come in and they would spend days preparing all the surfaces, smoothing out the cracks, getting it ready for him. They would mix his colors so that he would turn up and he'd be ready to go to kind of do the magic, right? Now, just because Michelangelo was the one who turns a dull ceiling into a masterpiece, that doesn't mean his junior painters think, well, there's nothing for us to do, we'll just sit around, it's all his work. No way. He's given them instructions. He would have brought them into the building and saying, this is what I want to do. I've got work for you to do. And so they crack on. And in some small way, those kind of junior artists, we probably never even know their names, but they are responsible in part and involved in just some of the most amazing bits of art ever. And it's just the same for us. Jesus is coming back. He's going to reverse the curse. He's going to wash the soil out of our planet and fix it. But until then, he says, look after it. Look after it. So as Christians, we don't sit back. We get on with caring for our local neighborhood. We're thinking carefully about the way we shop, with considering all kinds of lifestyle choices that maybe we haven't considered up until this moment. But we do that differently to the world around us, because we know that it's only Christ who can really fix things. And so we're desperately looking forward to when he comes back, when we get taken to Revelation, the Garden City. Let me pray. Father, we admit that we too rarely think about your natural world as a gift that you've given to us, because you love us, because you want to look after us. We too rarely think about the fact that we're alive today because you cause the sun to shine and the rain to fall so that crops grow and so that tummies are filled. We're sorry for when we don't live in your world carefully. Help us to love you and love our neighbors is the way we live. Help us to consider carefully how we might change. And help us to look forward all the more to Jesus coming back, when he'll wash away all the sin in the soil and make everything right again. Amen.
Ian's going to join me at the front, and I've got a few questions for him, and then I'm going to get a few other church family members up at the front, just as we continue to think through implications of this for our lives today. I really want to begin a conversation this evening. Ian, first question is, it's about the sort of the 2 Peter passage, and the sort of link back to 1 Peter 1. Yeah, how we know 1 Peter isn't talking about utter destruction, how 2 Peter isn't talking about utter destruction. How is it obvious that this is purification language?
Yeah, okay. Can everyone hear? No, I can speak with this. The position I'm arguing for here is that the language in 2 Peter, that it is not language of total destruction of the planet and starting again with new raw ingredients. There are brilliant Christian brothers and sisters who disagree with me. And so what I want to say is, what I'm suggesting is I'm not going to fight for it massively hard, but I think it's probably right. And I would go to, this is really tricky. I would go to 1 Peter. I'm sorry, I probably should have just done this in more detail when I was speaking. I'd go to somewhere like 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 7. Peter is writing to Christians who are kind of scattered, and life is very, very difficult. They're going through trials. And speaking about these trials, he says in verse 7, "These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold," okay, so there's language here of like gold, "which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed." So what I just kind of want to say is, just at least in Peter's mind, when he's been writing these letters and speaking about fire, there's an issue here of not fire that destroys, because the whole point in 1 Peter is, don't let your trials destroy you, persevere. Rather, let your trials refine your faith, make you purer in following the Lord. And that language that applies there also applies in 2 Peter. But even if you just said, do you know what? I think 2 Peter is just about destruction and starting afresh. So therefore, it doesn't really matter how Christians treat the planet. I'm going to say, well, what are you going to do about Genesis, where God says, care for the world around you? If you think it's all about starting anew, then isn't it interesting why he starts with a garden in Genesis 1 and he finishes with a garden city? It's kind of the same, but not quite the same. It's not totally new. So there's some discontinuity, some change, but stuff stays the same.
Somebody asked a really practical question. What is a church can we be doing that's practical to encourage looking after the planet? They provide examples, turning off unnecessary lights, reusable mugs for tea. Any other recommendations, things you think we should be thinking about, perhaps as a family of churches?
I mean, it's a good question. There's an organization called Arosha, which is a Christian group of people thinking really hard about what it means individually and corporately to live as God's people. And one of the things they do, in fact, the Church of England has taken on, is kind of doing like a corporate audit of like all your practices. You know, should you be using disposable cups? Should you be just using mugs? I mean, some of the kind of quite mundane things, which that's something you could corporately take on and think about. Think about that maybe on a small group level. But let's just always be thinking about like what's driving us. How are we acting differently to the world around us? But don't let it stop there. It's the nitty-gritty. And for that, you'll need wisdom. And also, can I just say, like, I think a bit of bravery to not rush some of your practical decisions. A lot of what's coming out is these calls to kind of, you know, give up meat, or do this, or do that. That sounds like my phone. No, it's not. Okay, that's fine. And then the science catches up and goes, do you know what? Actually, it's not quite as straightforward, as simple as we thought. So I think as Christians, we should, we know the kind of direction of travel in terms of the need to live sensitively, but we mustn't let ourselves be bullied into making quick changes that actually make things worse.